we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover this week. Pretty busy week. Starting out with local and drones. Drones for Seattle.
Yeah, we've been talking quite a bit on the show about the Seattle Police Department purchasing two drones and getting permission from the FAA to run a pilot program with aerial drones in the city of Seattle. Now, initially, when the Seattle Police bought these drones and rolled them out to the public months later, they said these drones could be used for things like search and rescue, you know, in case anyone gets lost
in the wilderness,
in the wilderness of, say, downtown Seattle or something of that nature. And you know, immediately people said, "What are you talking about? You need the SPD needs aerial drones. Obviously, they're going to want to use them eventually for surveillance." And the police department said, "Well, you know, we bought them, we have them, we might as well use them. We're going to develop policies and how to use them."
As though, you know, buying them was just this accidental windfall that fell into their lap, and they really didn't have any clue as to what they might be used for.
Or what else?
Now, as long as we got them, we might as well figure out some practical application.
Or what else they might use the money for?
Donuts.
City council member Bruce Harrell, who's running for mayor, came up with a proposed ordinance this week that he rolled out for the city council, and they had a hearing
on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, and the ordinance, of course, I got a copy of the ordinance and read it, and you know, went through and highlighted certain parts of it. But then my overall summation, I went back to the first page and just wrote on there, why the heck not just ban the drones altogether, like the city of Charlottesville, Virginia did?
Yeah, and they did that earlier this week. They did a 2-year moratorium. It wasn't an outright ban, but effectively it was.
But effectively it is for the next 2 years.
And the Harrell proposal, you know, laid out a number of things that they couldn't do that SPD wanted them to do. They couldn't be used for general surveillance, only on, quote, data collection for a, quote, specific target. They had to avoid data collection on individuals, homes, or areas other than the target, whatever that target might be. But violations of that were okay if they were collected in good faith, and that almost literally was the exact wording. They couldn't be weaponized. They could only use facial recognition or biometric matching technology for confirmation of the identity of a specific target. You couldn't use them over open air gatherings of large numbers of people, in other words, protests.
Mm-hmm.
But it did actually legitimize the use of the drones. And a day after that, of course, Mayor McGinn, who is one of Harrell's opponents in the race for mayor this year, trumps that by coming out and saying, "Well, we're not going to use them at all."
Yeah, and Mayor McGinn said, "Well, I've talked to Chief of Police Diaz, and we're going to take the two drones that we purchased, and we're going to send them back to the vendor." But that comes with a big but. He didn't say we're going to not ever use drones. He left the door open to say, "Well, we're not going to use this model. We're not going to use them now. We're not going to undertake the pilot program." He left a big door open, just as Harrell's ordinance left a big door open for the police to use the drones in emergency circumstances if they thought anyone's life was in danger or they would be chasing a suspect who could be violent. That they could keep and potentially use any data that they collected that might show indication of crime, just like, you know, they're going to be doing with these waterfront cameras. Any data that's collected by mistake while they're being used for maybe a training purpose or something, they could eventually use against a potential suspect.
It's not like, you know, there's any Fourth Amendment protections or you know, a court order overseeing this or anything like that. The other thing that was interesting about this in terms of Harrell and his proposal was that when McGinn came out, and of course Harrell's running against him, Harrell immediately attacks him from the other side and says he was very disappointed in McGinn pulling the plug on these because he wanted his legislation to be the model for how to use them responsibly. So that what that tells you was that in both cases, these guys were both A, looking for political advantage, but B, both they and the police department that they are seeking to curry favor from. And remember, McGinn has had really a pretty dreadful record throughout his tenure on not holding SPD accountable for some of its many abuses. Both of them are looking for ways to leave the door open that these can be used in the future with a minimum of oversight and public attention. I think what what we saw this week was it's an election year, and there's a lot of public attention on this, and they don't want the public attention, and they don't want the public to be thinking about this when, in fact, they do implement this program, and these will come back, and these models are getting smaller. In fact, the ones that the ones that SPD ordered were something like 2.5 pounds, and a new one came out on the market this week that's like 16 ounces.
Yeah,
they're getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah. And I was, and like Job, I was disappointed. I mean, Harrell could have said, I introduced the ordinance because their purchase was a fact. They were here. We needed a way to control them. And when McGinn came out and announced, I'm sending the drones back, we're not going to do the program, Harrell could have declared victory and said, great, you know, this is cool. Look, by introducing my ordinance, I stopped it dead in the water. Instead, he called McGinn a coward and said, oh, he should have kept the drones. We should have started using them just with my ordinance, blah, blah, blah. I thought that was particularly cowardly myself.
Yes, I have another word for it, but we really can't say that. It's not FCC compliant, no.
But as John said, yes, it is definitely an election.
It involves chickens anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
I listened to the entire talk. And in fact, you as a listener can listen tomorrow because we're going to air it from 7 to 8. But a couple things that struck me. One was that they said that these drones, the current ones that they have, would be obsolete within 2 years and would need to be replaced, which then in light of McGinn's statement really makes it that, to me, makes it that less significant because they're already saying these things are old, and so this is great. This opens it up for us. Send these old ones back. Give us, you know, some.
Well, in a couple of years, we'll get the latest model.
In mind also the DOD, the Obama administration, and the manufacturers are heavily promoting and heavily subsidizing sales of these to law enforcement agencies and to the private sector so as to help develop and legitimize the technology, since they've already invested so heavily in it for military uses. And that in turn legitimizes and normalizes it for some of the military operations that we've seen that have also been controversial.
That was another item that came out in the talk, was that King County had actually at one point had one of these drones and had turned it in.
They were going to join the SPD in this pilot program. It was going to be shared between the two departments. And King County, John Urquhart got into office and he said, oh no, we're not going down that slope.
Yeah,
you know, we already have problems with public accountability and people's attitudes towards the police department here. We're not going to start introducing these unmanned aerial drones. That's just a
And two things about that.
A public relations nightmare.
Yeah, the two things about that. Number one, it tells you why we needed somebody new that's more of an outsider as sheriff. But above and beyond that, King County within its jurisdiction does have wilderness areas.
I know.
And it tells you when King County is talking about, well, we don't need these, it tells you how ridiculous that original claim by the City of Seattle was. They weren't looking at that for search and rescue at all.
That's very true.
All right. I'm sure we'll be revisiting this all soon enough. Let's move on to the Pacific Place Garage.
Yeah, there were a couple of examples this week of public-private partnerships gone bad. The city has been losing money on the Pacific Place Garage for a long time. Now, if you remember back to 1997 when Nordstrom said, well, we want to build a flagship store downtown. We want to have a flagship store downtown. And they got together a group of private developers called the Pine Street Group to redevelop help redevelop the Pike Pine Corridor downtown. And they went to the city and cut this public-private partnership deal with the city at that time, with the city council and the mayor at that time, for the city to pay $73 million to buy a $50 million parking garage.
And there was also a whole thing around using taxpayer money to do this by declaring the blocks around there, because the old Frederick and Nelson store went out of business, as quote-unquote blighted, which was originally supposed to be an anti-poverty program.
Yeah. And in return for spending, you know, a 46% premium to buy a parking garage that cost only $50 million to build, the city got a quote-unquote asset. Does this sound familiar? They got an asset to manage and to collect revenue from. That's the parking garage. Now, they thought, of course, when you pay a premium for an asset like that, you expect you're going to recoup some of that premium over the life of the asset that you're going to be collecting revenue, in this case parking revenues, that are going to recoup some of that money.
Maria, tell them what the taxpayers won.
So for about, and you know, that did happen for about 5 or 6 years, the garage made a little bit of money, a modest amount of money. But then 2004 hit, and gas prices rose, got higher, and people started, the novelty wore off, and people in Seattle started asking themselves, why am I paying $5 an hour to pay for parking when I go shopping in downtown, when I can just drive to Northgate or South Center, park for free, and shop all day? Well, it turned out, of course, then the recession hit. And the parking garage started to lose money, because when the recession hit, fewer people were shopping, and when they went shopping, they didn't want to pay for parking. And the only people who were shopping downtown really were tourists, and tourists don't drive and park. They get off the cruise ship, they take a cab up the hill, and they don't use the garage.
Or people who are shopping on breaks from working downtown, and of course they have their own means of getting downtown. Either they take public transit, or the buildings they work in have their own private parking.
Yeah, sometimes, which is much cheaper than paying $5 an hour. So essentially, the city poured millions of dollars into what is now a money pit. The city owes $59 million in construction bonds on the garage. The city has poured $6 million into garage operations since 2010, with no hope of getting any of that money back, because the garage operations at this point are losing money, so the city's had to subsidize those. Now the city wants to unload the garage at a loss. They want to sell it for $55 million to Pine Street Group, the company that originally helped them build it and got the $73 million from the city to build it and to redevelop the area in the first place. The city, of course, as part of the sale agreement, is going to put yet another $5 million into operations of the garage while the sale agreement is being negotiated, in order to make sure that the operations continue. And I have to say, you know, there is no better example of how not to run a commercial asset by a government agency. You know, if you were a private company running this asset, you'd be saying, okay, now's the time to stop the hemorrhaging. Close the garage, stop putting money into operations, look around, see if you can find another group to buy it, you know, and who wants to buy it for more than $55 million, so you're not doing a short sale and not taking a loss on it. And if you can't, then you at least unload the thing, cut your losses, and be done with it. And tell yourself, I'm not ever entering into anything like that again.
Yeah, we wouldn't possibly want to have you know, the government spending more money on you know, enormous buildings in order to benefit private property owners. Chris Hansen.
Third Arena.
Yeah.
and then I want to point out that this week there was news about another bad public-private partnership deal. That was the city said this week that they are settling their lawsuit with Building 11 LLC. That's the group of private developers who were redeveloping Building 11 at Magnuson Park. That's out at Sandpoint Way, the old Sandpoint Naval Station. The city will end up paying $7.5 million to those private developers to complete renovations on Building 11 at Sandpoint. Now, that's an expensive building renovation, $7.5 million. Former Mayor Nichols and the city council back in 2008 approved the deal for a mixed-use project that would include a medical clinic, restaurants, and some mix of affordable housing. Of course, the developer would then pay to upgrade the building and would rent it out and get rent credits for affordable housing. And, of course, there would be tenants in the building, and so that would,
and
that
how
would
is,
be a good
and how
thing,
is
right?
affordable defined?
Good
I'm,
question.
I'm just curious.
Good question. And so, but the problem with the deal, of course, was that the agreement was signed before anyone asked neighbors and tenants, current tenants of Building 11, what they thought of the deal. And as soon as they learned about the deal, they were up in arms. They said, we don't want commercial development in a public park. Building 11 sits in the middle of Magnuson Park. And then the city council revisited the agreement and said, well, okay, we want to change the agreement, incorporate what some of the neighbors want and what some of the tenants of the current tenants of the building want. And then the private developer said, well, you can't do that. They turned around and they sued the city, and hence now we have this $7.5 million lawsuit. And of course, the $7.5 billion payments means that the city, having spent all this money on this building now, they're left with an asset to manage that they'll never recoup the money on. Unless, of course, they turn around and they rent that money out to commercial tenants. They'd have to probably kick out the current tenants and get in there, you know, fast food restaurants and, you know, who knows what commercial tenants, and create an eyesore in the middle of a beautiful public park.
All right. On to transportation issues.
Yeah. And so as if we haven't learned our lesson with problems with public-private partnerships, we have problems with transportation issues. The city of Seattle is talking about extending. This week they rolled out their downtown connector trolley line. Now, the city has built one trolley line, the South Lake Union Trolley, which goes from downtown up to South Lake Union, and is used by some of the residents in South Lake Union, used by a lot of tourists. And they've allocated money and are starting to plan and build the First Hill line, which would connect First Hill and the International District. And they've been talking about a connector line that will connect the South Lake Union trolley north of downtown to the First Hill line south of downtown. And there are two routes that they're studying. One is the city's preferred route along First Avenue, and the other is the route that would be used the most, the well-traveled commuter route that would go along 4th and 5th Avenue. Of course, the city does not prefer the commuter route because that would be too useful. They prefer the First Avenue connector line, which would be used mostly by tourists.
Well, and you mentioned too useful. Let's back up here and define useful, because the trolley lines that have been built so far have not been built to solve any existing transportation problems. They have been built as with the downtown tunnel, with all these other mega expensive transportation projects that the city underwrites for real estate development purposes.
Yeah.
The reason we saw the SLET, which is to say the South Lake Union Trolley in the first place, which was the first of these streetcar lines, was so that it would increase Paul Allen's South Lake Union property holdings values, so that, you know, you get more money and out of the banks for them, because again it shows that the city was investing in infrastructure in the neighborhood. Same thing with the First Hill line, and now we're seeing it with the routing, where you're going to have a bunch of property owners coming in around waterfront development with the viaduct coming down, and you know they want to be able to go back to their investors and show that the city is investing in infrastructure, you know, down toward the water.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're preferring that route. It has nothing to do with actually moving people.
Nothing to do with helping with Seattle's traffic congestion. The Texas Transportation Institute this week issued its urban mobility report that placed Seattle number 9 on the list of cities in the United States with the worst traffic congestion. Seattleites lose 48 hours a year to traffic congestion. This is the city's response, is to build a line that will not be used by commuters. In the meantime, King County Metro bus service is saying that if no new revenue is allocated to them, if no new money comes in 2014, they're going to have to cut bus service by 16%.
Even though the demand is way up.
At a time when ridership is at historic highs. Right now, 42% of all downtown commuters ride the bus. 42%, that's the majority of downtown commuters ride the bus. Only 35% drive, and the rest walk, bike, or telecommute.
All right, on to the state Senate training wage bill.
Yeah, the state Senate has introduced a training wage bill. That's Senate Bill 5275. It would institute a training wage, meaning that employers who hire new employees of any kind, not just teenagers, as senators are saying this bill would be used for, any new employee could be paid a training wage of that is only 75% of state or federal minimum wage for the first 680 hours a new employee works.
If you're
full-time, that's 17 weeks. If you're part-time, that's most of the year. If you think about it, it's up to 8 months if you're only halftime.
17 weeks is longer than the legislative session, and some of these are new legislators who were just just elected. So
let's pay them $689
an
hour.
Wouldn't that cover them as well? I could save a lot of taxpayer money that way.
Yeah. So I did a little. I got out my calculator, did a few calculations, and realized that at $6.98 an hour, if you're full time, you're only making $1,100 a month, which is 34% less than the average rent in the city of Seattle.
Yeah, and if you want food or clothing or anything else
Forget
like
about
that,
it.
You're out of luck.
Yeah.
I just saw a stat where the bulk of the people working, I think it was actually at McDonald's, are actually, it's not teenagers. They only make up like
right.
less than 10%. The bulk of them are like people our age.
The recession is such that these training wage jobs would not go to teenagers. They'd go to adults who really do need to pay rent and make a living.
All right. So we're already starting to run short on time. On to national and back to drones. Or at least the white paper.
Yeah, we saw a leaked 15-page white paper from the Obama administration on their legal rationale for killing U.S. citizens with no charges or trial. Now, the actual legal justification for this is still classified. This is a summary. This is a white paper.
Yeah.
And Attorney General Eric Holder came out and gave sort of a verbal summary of what the administration's arguments were last year, and we saw actually on paper now for the first time what rationalizations they were used to possibly reconcile that with gross violations of Article 3 of the Constitution, with due process, with the Fourth Amendment, with the Fifth Amendment, with the Sixth Amendment.
Yeah, what I find interesting about this white paper is that it's supposed to be a summary of a memorandum that was drafted that allowed the Obama administration to assassinate Anwar al-Awlaki, the Muslim cleric who was a U.S. citizen who had moved to Yemen and was who was recruiting for al-Qaeda, essentially. He was doing sermons where he was telling young men, go join al-Qaeda and fight evil America.
And they killed a 16-year-old son 2 weeks
and
later,
his
too.
His son, yes. And what I think very important about this is that if this is the memo that gives them justification, they've violated, by killing Anwar al-Awlaki, they've violated the terms even of this vague summary. Because in this vague summary, it says that American citizens will only be targeted for assassination if they are senior operational members of al-Qaeda engaged in planning operations to kill Americans. Anwar al-Awlaki, unless they can produce evidence that he was a senior operational member of al-Qaeda, does not qualify.
Well, and that's the whole point, is they don't have to produce any evidence. We have to take them at their word regardless. And, you know, the terms that were used, Holder, when he laid out the justification less formally last year, said it was basically a three-prong test. And the first of those prongs was imminent threat, that the person had to pose an imminent threat to the safety of the United States, which, of course, al-Awlaki did not.
Did not, no.
But you look at the wording of that in this document, and even that is just riddled with vagueness, so that imminent threat doesn't require the U.S. to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. That's a direct quote from the memo. Instead, a, quote, informed high-level official of the United States government may determine that targeted Americans has been, quote, recently involved in, quote, activities posing a threat of violent attack, and that, quote, there's no evidence suggesting that he's renounced or abandoned such activities. In other words, proving a negative. There's no definition of recently. There's no definition of activities. There's certainly no definition of informed or high level in terms of what an official is. And you can just go through and, you know, there's about a dozen of these terms, any one of which it would be easier to modify than, to pick a random example, the Bush administration trying to make a case for a massive invasion of a country in the Middle East based on false premises. This can be badly abused, not just by the Obama administration, but it sets a legal precedent for any future administration, whether it's Obama, whether it's Hillary Clinton in 2016, whether it's Marco Rubio or Paul Ryan in 2016, any of these folks can go back and use this. It's very, very frightening.
And finally, my reaction to the memo was, where's the outcry over the use of assassination against lower-level recruits to al-Qaeda that's been going on in Yemen, guys who are just have been recruited, not even been trained? Those are the folks who are being targeted, and civilians around them by drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia and places like that.
All right. Cyber attacks.
Yeah, we also learned this week that there's a top secret memorandum, they call it a legal review, that would allow President Obama to authorize preemptive cyber attacks. And I say that knowing that this should not be a surprise, because we've been engaging in preemptive cyber attacks against Iran for some time now.
You knew somebody would have had to come up with some kind of a justification.
Yeah. But it's important to know that top secret memorandum exists, because now people can ask for it and demand it and say we want to see what the justifications for this would be and what the red line is, what would trigger such an attack, because I think that's very, very important. Of course, I should also mention, too, that this whole idea of a cyber 9/11 and the scare tactics around cyber attacks, when we in fact are the main perpetrator of cyber attacks in the world, is yet another way for the military and military contractors to ensure continuous funding for extremely expensive military programs at a time when they're more at a threat of being cut than at any time in the last 50 years or so.
Yeah, and you talk about red line. You know, it's very analogous to nuclear weapons in terms of, you know, we have a first strike policy. We strike first on these. That's what preemptive attacks is all about.
And speaking of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, we had a report from the Center for Public Integrity this week that national security leaders, and that includes the State Department, DOD, National Security Council, Intelligence Agency, Strategic Command, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Biden's Vice Presidential Office, they have all signed off on a plan to reduce nuclear warheads by one-third. Obama has not signed that plan yet, but is said to be in agreement with it. It was completed last year, but kept quiet during the election season because, of course, heaven forbid that Republicans get a hold of an idea that we might not be able to nuke the world 45 billion times over. But it also calls for negotiating an addendum and further reductions on the 2010 New START treaty with Russia, wherein the United States would not only cut deployed warhead levels by about a third, but also for the first time begin to constrain the size of those additional categories. But if you look at the fine print in this, the administration last year debated but rejected much steeper reductions to 500 that would have involved changing the targeting rationale so that rather than using first strike rationales to target enemies, it would be strictly for defensive purposes and a much narrower range of targeting. Now, China has already moved toward that. The Russian Federation, of course, has a much diminished nuclear capacity at all. And so, as Maria was saying about contractors in terms of the cyber attacks, you're seeing this bureaucratic inertia and the corporate welfare rationale for maintaining a massive nuclear capacity that, basically was, if it was ever relevant, was obsolete 20 years ago when the Soviet Union collapsed. It's great that they're talking about cutting them by a third, but it needs to be abolished, period.
Yeah.
That leaves us a minute left for rendition.
Yeah, that's fine. The Open Society Justice Initiative issued a new report this week that says 54 nations helped facilitate the CIA's detention, rendition, and torture program after September 11th, 2001. Some of those nations hosted prisons, or in the case of, say, for example, Lithuania, actually built a special prison for the CIA to use for its rendition program. Some let the CIA use their airports, some tortured detainees, others captured and turned people over, some of their own citizens and residents, to the CIA to be part of the rendition program without any judicial review process. The report names about 136 people who were rendered, who were part of a meatpacking plant. Doesn't it? Who were part of the rendition program and details what happened to them. It is chilling reading, and I suggest people go online, look at the report. I also want to point out that 25 nations in Europe were part of this program, 14 in Asia, 13 in Africa, and Canada and Australia. You can find that report online at www.opensocietyfoundations.org. That's Open Society Foundations, plural, .org.
Yeah, and I've read it also, and if you're going to read what happened to these people, don't eat just beforehand.
Yeah.
It really is bad.
Yeah.
Events.
Several of them. Today at 5:30, there will be a candlelight vigil and march to end gun violence. That will be starting up at St. Mark's Cathedral at the north end of Capitol Hill at 1245 10th Avenue. There was another one today also. Is that?
Yeah, there's
Homestead.
Yes, yeah. Sustainable Northeast Seattle is hosting their third annual homesteading skills event where you can go and learn how to do little things like make your own cheese, beekeeping, basic plumbing repairs, the sort of things that help you get by in a recession and help you do things for yourself.
And then Wednesday night on the 13th from 7:30 to 9, there will be a panel on the coal train proposals that are being floated for five different Oregon and Washington state ports that moving the coal from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. That'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca, near downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find some of my back articles at mariatomchik.com.